Hey there, Rick Singeri of Vermont Edition. Just want you to know this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. On Saturday afternoon, the Senate took a final vote and confirmed Brett Kavanaugh as the newest Associate Justice to the U.S. Supreme Court after a bitter, partisan, and nationally captivating confirmation process. Kavanaugh was sworn in almost immediately afterwards. But the ramifications of this confirmation and all that came along with it are still to play out. Kavanaugh himself suggested that this would have a lasting effect on U.S. politics, the reputation of the Supreme Court, and the bitter partisan divide in the country. The Kavanaugh hearings spurred many of us to have public and private conversation we perhaps hadn't had before. Conversations about sexual assault in particular. People have been sharing stories of why they didn't report when they were sexually assaulted. Some have been telling partners, parents, loved ones, even the world via social media for the first time about their experience with assault. The bitterness after this process runs deep into American politics and American culture. And even though it's not particularly a Vermont story, it's also not a Vermont story. This is what so many people are thinking and talking about. And so today on VPR and Vermont Edition, we thought we'd open up the phones for some reflection and reaction as a Vermont and local community. How are you feeling? What are you thinking? And where do we go from here? And joining us to weave through this conversation is Lisa Holmes. Holmes is an associate professor of political science at UVM. She studies judicial politics, constitutional law, and gender and law. And her research focuses on the politics of judicial appointments. It's lovely to have you here, Professor Holmes.
Good afternoon, Jane. Thank you for having me.
So this must have felt like exactly what you have been looking at and studying and writing about for your career the last few weeks.
It is. It's been a busy few weeks.
Do you have any sort of general reflections, or do you want me to dive right in with some specific questions for you? Because I'm curious. I mean, this is your bailiwick. This is what you do.
This is what I do.
You know, I mean, you can treat me like your class of students if you want, and then we can go into some specific questions.
Sure. I think maybe the one big picture thing that I would say right from the front is that on one level, the stakes here were so much higher because this is the U.S. Supreme Court, a very closely divided U.S. Supreme Court. But I think in a more general sense, it also reflects the approach to judicial appointment politics and how increasingly partisan and polarized it's become, not just for the Supreme Court, but for federal courts and even in some state judiciaries as well.
So this felt like a continuation or sort of the end of the line of something that you've already seen coming in some ways?
Well, I wouldn't call it the end of the line, but it is a stopping point. I would expect, of course, this politicization to continue. That's what we've been seeing for a number of years now.
So you're speaking then specifically about the bitter politics and the partisan divide of the Kavanaugh hearings, not necessarily about the sexual assault allegations, or do those all roll in together for you?
For me, I tend to think of them somewhat distinctly in that this was already going to be the expectation was, even before the allegations arose, that he would very likely be confirmed in a largely partisan vote.
And then the sexual assault allegations
Yes.
came in. And for many people, there isn't that dividing line. This feels partisan. This feels politically motivated, politically driven. Judge Kavanaugh said he thought it was politically driven, although
Yes.
there's no evidence that Christine Blasey Ford or the other accusers have been motivated by their politics. So it does, in many ways, to many people, feel like a continuation of that bitter partisan divide that you talk about.
Yeah, well, I think that that's right, that there is some merging of these two issues. And I think perhaps where you stand on that might depend on where you sit in terms of whether you think that this was all motivated by partisanship or whether these allegations, which had come up relatively late in the process, were distinct and separate from the partisan battle that was already sort of forming at the core of his nomination.
Does that do a disservice to both the judge and to Christine Blasey Ford that these allegations arose in what was already such a highly charged political atmosphere?
I think what's pretty clear is that from what we've heard from both of those people, that they strike me as thinking that this did do them a definite disservice. And what it meant, of course, was that any consideration of the allegations were mired in this time-constrained, very high-profile national event. I don't know what your listeners or your callers might think about that or do with that information. But I do think the allegations, of course, merged into what was already an important partisan high-profile appointment process.
And they were used that way by both sides, but yes, particularly by the Democrats in terms of the timing of when to bring them out. And certainly some things were leaked, and it's still unclear
it
how
is.
That was leaked. But the timing, I mean, it seems like the information that the Democrats had about potential allegations against Judge Kavanaugh, they tried to make sure to bring those out at a politically expedient time.
That's a hard thing to summarize or to know because, of course, a lot of this hinges on what Senator Feinstein was doing and what her motivation was for holding these. She did, of course, say publicly multiple times that she held on to these allegations in order to try to protect Dr. Blasey Ford's confidentiality. But as you noted, they got leaked somehow. She claims that it was not her that leaked them. Maybe we will never find out who leaked these. But obviously, there's a lot of consternation over how those allegations came to light and when those allegations came to light.
We are talking about, I guess it's probably not the end of the Kavanaugh situation, but certainly Judge Kavanaugh has been confirmed. He is now a Supreme Court justice, and we're looking at how this feels to people in Vermont and where you think we go now. I mean, how do we come back together as a state, as a country? Is that something that you want? Is that something that we do now? Does this mark a particular stopping point, or is this the middle of the road in what is going to get even more bitter? Kate writes in to say, I'm a survivor of sexual assault. I was raped as a freshman in college by someone I knew. I never told a soul until years later when I confided in a therapist. And the experience has caused me immense suffering during a vulnerable period of my life. The process the Senate underwent with Kavanaugh, regardless of his guilt or innocence, is inexcusable and speaks volumes about our values as a country. It sadly makes clear to women and girls what to expect if they come forward, as Dr. Ford bravely did. It also sends a message to boys and men that is equally appalling. But Alpha 1-6 says, from what I've observed by watching C-SPAN's coverage of Justice Kavanaugh, he had impeccable credentials as an appellate court judge. His decisions agreed with the chief judge, Merrick Garland, 96% of the time. Maybe he means the Chief Justice and Merrick Garland. Some of his decisions were used by the Supreme Court as a basis for their decisions. He was highly recommended by his associates, his clerks, his neighbors, virtually everyone who's had contact with him. He will be an outstanding justice. And Alpha 1-6 goes on, Ms. Ford made an unsubstantiated allegation regarding an incident 36 years ago. I don't think that you can destroy a man's life unless you can substantiate the charges. Let's go to Nicholas, who's calling in from Glover. Hi, Nicholas. You're on the air.
Good morning. The point I wanted to make was that I find it entirely plausible that there are two Kavanaughs. Well, the last 3 years in my college were at a university where there were a lot of Greek societies. Pledges were asked to do stupid things like put their head in the toilet, drink excessively, run around with panties on their head, and so forth. I find it quite possible that Kavanaugh was an unprincipled jerk when he was an undergraduate. Then he graduated from school, went to a serious graduate school, evidently met a serious woman who helped upgrade him, and perhaps he's lived an impeccable life since then. I think that that begs the question of whether he was a jerk or whether he committed sexual assault when he was an undergraduate. And I'm glad he's had an exemplary life since then, but Ms. Blasey Ford would not forget who sexually assaulted her when she was 15 years old and had a rather limited set of friends. So I believe her. I don't believe him. I think he dissembled. And you can still see traces of his poor undergraduate behavior in the way he acted before the committee.
Well, Nicholas, I appreciate your comment. Thanks for weighing in. Let's go to Sarah in Salem, New York. Hi, Sarah.
Yeah, hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call. I want to first concur with the person that commented right before me. I agree with him completely. I know plenty of white men that have split personalities when they're drunk. Sadly, my brothers being one of those in that class. But I think this really is about partisanship. I think Mitch McConnell went down this road with the Merrick Garland nomination and deciding to deny a president his constitutional right to appoint someone. I think this is going to get worse. And I think one of the reasons it's going to get worse is the appointment of Brett Kavanaugh is a shining example of how I'm sorry, but white men of privilege will do anything to hold on to their position of privilege and power, despite its unfairness and injustice. And Brett Kavanaugh is, frankly, in my opinion, a revolting example of a man of white privilege who gets what he wants, despite his behavior, because of his privilege and his position.
So, Sarah, what do you do next now? I mean, if that's how you feel, is that just you lump it, or do you take action somehow?
It's in my local election. I am writing. I was writing and calling senators as much as I possibly could stomach. And I don't know. I'm really incensed and outraged. And quite frankly, I feel very desperate about the state of our country at this point and our democracy, because I think the Constitution has been run over. And I do blame largely the Republicans for that. I think the Democrats made a lot of mistakes, but I think they decided to try to fight back on a similar tactic that the Republicans have been using for since Obama was president. So it's a sad state of affairs, and I think it's going to get worse, because I think those people that have the power and privilege are going to fight like hell to keep it. And I think that's what's happening right now.
Sarah, thanks for your comment. Appreciate hearing your perspective. And let's get another one in here from Alan in Ferrisburg. Hi, Alan.
Hi.
Go right ahead.
Okay, thanks. I was just wondering why the big surprise that it's partisanship. It's always been partisan. But I would like to add to that, that why don't they concentrate, or why doesn't the people of this country, I'm Canadian, but why don't the people of this country concentrate on focusing on the hiring of a Supreme Court replacement by the Supreme Court itself? They're the people that work with each other. I mean, I've never heard that opinion voiced, and it just seems, why does the president appoint them and the Senate approve them? Of course it's going to be partisan. Why not take it out of the political system and make it a job?
Alan, that's an interesting question. Let's turn that to Lisa Holmes, because, you know, for one thing, Alan's saying, of course it's partisan. We wouldn't expect it to be any other way. And certainly, I think in this day and age, yes, that's true. Certainly, these appointments have been very partisan, very chosen by the party in power to preserve that power on into the future. But Alan also suggests then have the Supreme Court choose, not the president.
Right. And Alan also asked, why do we do it this way? And the person that I go to answer that question for us is Alexander Hamilton, who wrote about this extensively in the Federalist Papers and argued that the president would be the best person to choose nominees, because the president would understand that this would be part of the legacy of that administration and would take it seriously. Hamilton also argued that the Senate should be the body to confirm as a check, but also argued that the Senate would not abuse this power because it was understood to reside predominantly with the president. Of course, one thing that Hamilton didn't really predict was the rise of political parties. Now, I also appreciated the comment of course, this is political. We call it judicial appointment politics for a reason, especially for the Supreme Court. Appointments have always been political. What I think we're running into right now is almost a perfect storm of a political process, hyper-partisanship, and the fact that the Supreme Court is so much more powerful and influential than it was, you know, 100, 200 years ago when the process was political, but the stakes just didn't seem so high.
So have you ever seen any Supreme Court appointment like this? Can we look back in time and say, look at this appointment back in, you know, the 1890s?
Well, it depends on what you mean by like this. You know, the obvious sort of more contemporary analogy is, of course, Clarence Thomas's nomination in 1991. But there were also appointments or failed appointments during the Nixon administration, when Supreme Court justices were voted down, arguably because of concerns over their decision making. So in both modern and earlier in our history, in modern American history and earlier on, we do have analogous situations to various aspects of, I think, what is happening today.
We got a note from John in Cornish who says, you know, reporters certainly won't stop investigating the facts leading to the accusations against Kavanaugh. That fact set me to wondering, has any Supreme Court justice ever been forced out by scandal?
Well, there are Supreme Court justices. The impeachment process applies to all federal judges. And there have been Supreme Court justices who have been subject to impeachment and removal, but none have been removed. That has happened on the lower bench, though. But also, if you want a very contemporary analogy on the lower courts, there is also absent impeachment. There are examples of judges on the lower federal bench leaving to avoid possible impeachment. One just last year was Judge Alex Kaczynski that, interestingly, Kavanaugh clerked for earlier in his career, who left as part of the Me Too era when a whole host of allegations went public against Kaczynski.
Let's go to another call here. Julie Lynn Gibbons is Director of Political Engagement for Vote Pro Choice Vermont, and she's on the line. Hi, Julie Lynn.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me. And I just a quick correction. Vote Pro Choice is actually a national organization. I just happen to be lucky enough to live here in Vermont.
Aha. So go right ahead.
Yeah, so I just, you know, Vote Pro Choice and I were lucky to be one of several organizations that hosted a total of 4 marches, rallies, and vigils across the state the last 2 weeks, along with Planned Parenthood Action Fund of Vermont, Vermont Women's March, and the Peace and Justice Center, among many others. And for me personally, this is obviously, it's a very sad time because it's not just about Roe v. Wade or women's rights. Brett Kavanaugh has a serious history against voting, weighing in on court opinions that have to deal with folks who have chronic health conditions like myself. So anybody who is a proponent of the Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, you know, that's in danger. LGBT Americans like myself, our freedom and equality is in danger. And he certainly has a history that was brought up by the Senate Judiciary Committee of going more in favor with corporate groups than individual folks. But at Vote Pro Choice, I will say that there is one remedy, and it's very close. And here in Vermont, we can jump in right away, which is to vote, because we know that 7 in 10 Americans actually do support a woman's right to choose and make decisions for herself. And our legislative bodies, both state and federally, do not represent this. So if folks can get out to vote, it's the people that are elected to office that make the decisions that go into appointing judges. And if we can vote the way we believe, then surely we can get folks elected and appointed who more side with the majority of Americans. And so I really encourage all Vermonters. We have this wonderful thing in Vermont, a privilege of voting early. You can vote now. And Vote Pro Choice has a pro-choice voter guide that folks can use. And so I'm grateful for everyone, the survivors, the men, the LGBT, disabled folks, et cetera, who all step forward. But this is not a time to be depressed, although I certainly am, but rather it's a time to move forward and elect officials who represent our views.
Well, Julie Lynn, thanks for sharing your perspective. And we've been getting a lot of comments from many of you. Deb in Jeffersonville says, what I wanted to hear Kavanaugh say was, quote, I did a lot of stupid things. I drank too much. I partied too much. It was the culture of the times and certainly the culture of privileged prep school jocks. I'm embarrassed and ashamed and I regret it. I can't imagine I did such a thing, but if I did, I don't remember it and I sincerely apologize. Deb says, if he had said that, I would have cut him some slack. Morgan says, to me, the most appalling aspect of the Kavanaugh confirmation process was that the media, perhaps informed by the politicians themselves, consistently discussed senators' decisions in the context of what vote would be most likely to get them reelected, rather than on what was the morally right thing for them to do. We need more people in Congress with the courage of Lisa Murkowski and Jim Jeffords. And Rich says, the turning point for me was the judge's behavior when recalled before the Judiciary Committee. While I can appreciate anger in the face of what he says are false accusations, turning exclusively to Fox News to publicize his defense, his arrogance towards the committee and invoking an unsubstantiated conspiracy against him that only played to one political base and inflamed the other were not judicial responses. All of this makes Kavanaugh the most political court appointment in my lifetime. It hurts the perceived neutrality of the court, and with that, the public's willingness to accept the voice of the court as the final arbiter of issues. I think this appointment makes another milestone that our political process has become myopic and it's broken. Lisa Holmes, what about this potential to change the way Americans think about the decisions made by the Supreme Court? That if Americans think this is just a political body, a partisan body, does that change how we view the decisions that the Supreme Court makes and how we then act on them.
Yes, it could do that. One bit of good news is that the political science research on this question is clear, that the public's faith in the judiciary, especially the Supreme Court, is quite deep, and it can sustain controversy. And a classic example of this was the Bush versus Gore decision in 2000. But what the leading research in this area also shows is that when the public is exposed to arguments, especially credible arguments, that the Supreme Court is a partisan branch of government, no different than any other, that could shake the public's faith in the judiciary. And I share the last comments that you read from one of your listeners, that the concern about that, because the judiciary in the American political system has very little formal power. We pay attention to them because we choose to pay attention to them. And if we start thinking of them as no more or less political hacks than anybody else perhaps in government, that could affect how we view the job that they do and perhaps even have implications for our sense of the rule of law.
When you say the court doesn't actually have that much real power, can you go a little deeper in that? Because it seems like when the court says something, when
yes.
the court makes a decision, that has the effect of the rule of law. That
yes.
is what, you know, that is what we rely on.
It
so
is.
We could just say, don't care.
Yeah. And I think that's a valid thing to at least be aware of. Again, I'm here. I'm going to cite Alexander Hamilton. He's the one who
said— Can you
sing
while you're doing this, please?
No, I cannot. But he wrote, for example, that the judiciary is the least dangerous branch of government in large measure because they don't have the power of the purse or the sword. They don't have the huge formal powers that come with the other branches of government. One classic, again, to harken back to Bush versus Gore from not very long ago, the day after the Bush versus Gore decision was announced, Al Gore got on television and said, "I don't agree with this decision, but the court has spoken. This election is over." You know, that is, I think, a strong illustrative example of the legitimacy of the contemporary Supreme Court, that a contested presidential election can end because the court says that it needs to end. So I'll leave it for viewers, of course, for listeners to decide whether they agreed or disagreed with the Bush versus Gore decision. But what happened in the wake of it is what I'm talking about here. In other countries, we could imagine the challenger in a contested presidential election saying, "No, we're moving forward with this challenge," over the court trying to indicate otherwise.
So that does happen in some countries.
Sure,
there is still a Supreme Court of the land, but its decisions are not taken with quite the force that they are here.
And another thing, you know, I can't speak with a whole lot of knowledge on this because I focus on the American judicial system. But what we are seeing in other countries, like in Poland, are clear attacks on the judiciary by the political branches. And again, I think all of these things kind of fit together in terms of what we expect out of the judiciary, how we view it, and what could in the long run. I'm not trying to suggest that everybody needs to be worrying that suddenly tomorrow this is all going to fall apart. But it is something to be attentive to, how we view the court and what that has meant for the court becoming increasingly influential and powerful in our political system.
Let's hear from a few more people who are sharing their thoughts with us. Mike is calling in from Proctor. Hey, Mike, what do you want to say today?
Hi, I'm calling about to express my concern about the numbers of women seemingly supporting Brett Kavanaugh. I think that they're conservative women, and thinking that conservatives generally don't believe in the idea of progress, and that we should try and keep things as traditional and the way things have been. And I'm just seeing that my sense is that these conservative women are voting in this regard, not as in terms of sexual oppression that so many of us are thinking about and railing about, and thinking that it's just part of the conservative idea of keeping things traditional and the way they were.
Mike, thanks for your comment. And Professor Holmes, I'd love to get your take on that. I mean, what do you think about that idea that Mike has, that conservative women want to keep things the way they are and want tradition, and how that might play into whether or not you support Brett Kavanaugh?
It could. But I tend to think of this as a more tribal partisan thing, that especially for people who support President Trump, they were more inclined, I suspect, to be supportive of Kavanaugh. This is maybe not quite what Mike was looking for with respect to his comment statement and his comments. But one thing that I thought was really interesting was all the attention that Susan Collins got and Lisa Murkowski got, you know, seemingly sort of forgetting that there were other women in the Senate that voted for Brett Kavanaugh, too.
Right. But weren't Murkowski and Collins mostly targeted because they were seen as the ones who were more likely to be moderate, to perhaps
Absolutely.
Go in the other direction?
Absolutely. So we don't focus on the other women. But I guess my point here is for those who are disappointed in Collins's actions and her ultimate vote, I can understand that, of course. But I just think it's important to kind of recognize that she's not the only woman who voted for him. But I tend to think I can't explain fully why Joni Ernst or some other women in the Senate voted for him or women in the electorate might support Brett Kavanaugh. It might have something to do, as Mike suggested, with a desire to keep things traditional. But I tend to think of this as being much more sort of tribalism on the partisan level of everybody stakes out their side, especially if you are strongly supportive of one party or the other.
Does a support of President Trump also play into that? I mean, if you are supportive or are trying to support the party of a president who has also been accused of sexual impropriety, does that make not supporting Brett Kavanaugh more difficult?
That's an interesting question. I'm not sure that it does or does not make it more difficult. But I think that one thing has been very clear, starting with exit polls from 2016, is that President Trump has capitalized very well on the fact that the Republican base cares a lot about judges, the Supreme Court most of all. It is clear that in the 2016 election, thinking about the judiciary, thinking about the Supreme Court, and having a current vacancy on the Supreme Court at the time was a bigger mobilizing factor for Trump supporters and Hillary Clinton supporters.
While we're talking about women and the split among women, among the many, many things that I was reading over the weekend was an article from The Root saying, hey, wait a minute. It's not a split among women. It's a split among white women that
yeah.
overwhelmingly women of color do not support yeah. Brett Kavanaugh.
Yeah, I think that's accurate. That's a fair thing to say, too.
And so this question of race, does this play out in some interesting subtext of the Kavanaugh hearings? Because that has not been the focus of conversation by any means.
No, it hasn't. So I can't predict how that's going to play out. I suspect that it will perhaps galvanize voters. But they're even, you know, speaking of voters as monolithic based on race is also really complicated. This could play out very differently with different parts of both the Republican and the Democratic constituency. But I agree with what you've said, that race has not been a primary factor in how this has played out. So it's sort of difficult for me to predict how that might affect votes in November.
You mentioned that traditionally Republicans have been much more galvanized
yes.
by this idea of Supreme Court vacancies and trying to fill the Supreme Court. And there's a lot of talk now about what this whole process with Brett Kavanaugh means for the November midterms and on to the elections 2 years from now as
right.
well. What do you think? Does this galvanize both sides? Are the Democrats really juiced by this now to go out and vote and sweep the blue wave and the pink and blue wave into
right.
power?
Right. Recent history tells us that this will clearly, and it already is, galvanizing the base Republican voters. And there was some polling that was released last week that highlights that the intensity gap between how motivated voters were to come out in November has shrunk. It's all but disappeared. I hear lots of arguments that this is and will galvanize the Democratic base and Democratic voters. But my thought on that is that we've heard that before, and that with respect to judges in particular, there's no clear evidence in recent history that the Democratic base cares about judges as much as the Republican base does. Maybe that is changing as we sit here and speak right now, but recent history indicates that this is something that conservative-based voters care about a lot more.
But even before this judicial appointment, there was a sense that more women were coming out to mm-hmm. run for office, and that's been borne
yes.
out. That's
yes.
that's an actual statistic.
Yes.
Whether or not more women vote, we'll see.
Right.
But that the Judge Kavanaugh hearings may if not be about judicial appointments, may also be about how sexual assault survivors are treated, how women are treated in this culture, and this whole question of Me Too. And so even if Democrats are not voting necessarily on judicial appointments, could they be galvanized by a sense of wronging against women?
Yeah, it could. I was thinking about this just as I was driving to your studio not an hour ago, that it's conceivable that we might see something of both of those things play out, that the Kavanaugh hearings and as part of the broader Me Too movement will, as you already noted, seems to be exacerbating the gender gap, which is the idea that women are more likely to vote Democrat than Republican and than men are, while also serving to be the thing that the Republican base needed to rally them.
Jared writes in to say about Judge Kavanaugh, his temperament was not exactly judicial. Dr. Blasey Ford was very credible, and he should not have gotten past this job interview. I'm very unhappy with this and the future implications given his record. Mark says, Kavanaugh is a great pick, someone who understands that the Constitution and laws mean what is on the paper, not what anyone wants them to be. And Jason in Shelburne says, I'd be curious if your guests can speak to the longevity of Supreme Court justices. As with so much in our founding, they didn't understand that judges might live longer. 30 years on the bench? I doubt the founders considered this. George Washington died in his mid-60s. It's time to look at term limits. What about that?
Well, I'm hearing that a fair amount now. You had a caller earlier, I believe it was the caller from Canada, who said, why not have judges selected through a completely different mechanism? I'm not hearing any of that. But what you are hearing, I think the New York Times, for example, I believe published something within the last few weeks about term limits. So you're hearing that a fair amount. I guess what I would say about that is I don't see that as happening. I think there is a valid argument for it because, as you just noted, Jane, when Hamilton was writing about the judiciary, we never expected that we would live as long as we do, that they would stay on the bench as long as they do. So perhaps term limits is not a solution, not a fix-all, but perhaps something that we could think about. But I would also say that at this moment in our political evolution, I tend to hear the argument in favor of term limits coming more from liberals than conservatives. Now that they're poised to get what they've been working for so long, it would be an impossible sell, I think, to get any buy-in on that issue.
From conservatives.
Absolutely.
So for you, looking at this and looking at the history that you've looked at and where this moment stands in our long history of the judicial process in America, Lisa Holmes, is this a blip? I mean, is this really interesting? Does this become the focus of study and research, or is this just one more step in, you know, we're always going through politics. We always have cultural moments. You know, this is just one more.
Well, with respect to the judiciary, I think it's one more, but I look at this controversy over judicial appointments as continuing to build on itself. So what happened with Merrick Garland is being built on here. And of course, you know, Republicans like to go back to the late 1980s with Robert Bork, and it's building on that. So I look at this as sort of a step, but we keep incrementally having the process be more and more problematic. And one other bit of evidence of this is, you know, effectively removing the filibuster so that now, so long as a president and the Senate are controlled by the same party, they don't need buy-in from the other party so long as they can vote as a bloc to confirm the president's choice.
Boy, it's interesting stuff, and I appreciate that you're studying it so we can come back to talk to you about it maybe, you know, 20, 30 years from now. You ready?
Yeah, something like that. Sure. Okay. Sure. I'll put it on my calendar.
Lisa Holmes is Associate Professor of Political Science at UVM. She studies judicial politics, constitutional law, and gender and law. Thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you for having me.